Ben, for inviting me. And yeah, so like I just said, today I'll be telling you about categorical Bernstein operators and a categorical boson for fermion correspondence. So I'll obviously tell you what those things are, but before I get there, I want to kind of motivate why one would want to do this or how this problem arose in the first place. So roughly, right, back in the 90s, we had Frankel. When he started this whole business of categorification, one of his main motivations was to categorify TQFTs. And one of the other things that he proposed that one could categorify is conformal field theory. But conformal field theory is kind of hard to deal with, right? And he said, well, why don't we start by categorifying vertex operator algebras and the vertex operators that arise within this context? But again, this is a very difficult problem to approach and to deal with. And so he suggested, well, let's start with the most basic situation here. Let's try to categorify the boson fermion correspondence. And it's VOA, or vertex operator formulation correspondence, if I can spell it correctly. But in order to do that, we needed to first realize, well, how do we approach a categorification of a vertex operator to begin with? And this problem basically kind of sat for 10, 15 years. People didn't know how to deal with it until 2011. We had the remarkable work of Caudes and Licata, where they realized categorical vertex operators as functors acting on two representations of Heisenberg categories, right? And so here, they basically, constructed one of the first examples of categorical vertex operators over a Heisenberg category. And then motivated by this construction and what Caudes and Licata did, then in 2013, Caudes and Sussin conjectured a categorical formulation of the boson-fermion correspondence using the same flavor of vertex off categorical vertex operators constructed in their work, right? So they conjectured a categorical boson-fermion correspondence. And it's precisely their conjecture that I'll just be discussing today and how one might go around, or how this was actually proven. So just to keep this in mind, so what is the main gist of this? The main idea behind the boson-fermion correspondence is you have some sort of Fock space, right? Let's call it for right now symmetric functions. So the ring of symmetric functions. And on the ring of symmetric functions, you have the actions of two very well-known algebras. Namely, you have the action of a Heisenberg algebra, and then you have the action of a Clifford algebra here. And the boson-fermion correspondence tells us how to relate one action to the other, and actually how to recover the action of the Clifford algebra from the Heisenberg, and the action of the Heisenberg from just knowing what the Clifford algebra action is doing, right? So this is known as the boson-fermion correspondence. And what we aim to do in this talk is categorify this entire construction. So just keep this in mind as I go through. And you'll see why the Bernstein operators actually show up in this formulation very naturally. So any questions? I mean, this is just introduction, but OK, great. So let's start with symmetric functions just very briefly. So what are the ring of symmetric functions, right? So we're going to denote symmetric functions by sim, right? And the ring of symmetric functions have several generators that we like. We have the power sum symmetric functions. So these are the power sums. We have the homogeneous symmetric functions. We have the elementary symmetric functions. And then we have our sure functions that are indexed by partitions. Now, the power sum symmetric functions are generators over Q. These are generators over Z. These are generators over Z. And then again, these are call them sure symmetric functions. These are generators over C. So we'll see that the fact that these are integral and this is not is going to play a big role in us, in the categorifications that we'll be seeing in the following construction. So one of the things that the ring of symmetric functions has, is a very natural inner product known as the Hall inner product, which tells us that the sure functions is defined so that the sure functions satisfy the following condition, right? Where this is the Kronecker delta. So if you give me two partitions and they are different, then you get zero, and it's one if they're the same, right? The reason that we like this inner product and that it's very useful is that it allows us to define natural adjoints with respect to multiplication for every symmetric function. Namely, if we think of symmetric functions as acting on themselves via multiplication, right, then we can define certain adjoint operators. Let's call it F perp. So if you have F in sim, you can define F perp such that if you act by F perp on any other function, let's call it phi, this is precisely the adjoint with respect to multiplication inside this inner product, right? And this allows us to define Pn perp, right? And we can view this as endomorphisms inside sim, right? We can define Hn perp, En perp, S lambda perp, all of these as operators on the ring of symmetric functions. In particular, we have, can I write behind this? Oh, I can, cool. In particular, one of the things that we might ask is, well, we have all these operators acting on the ring of symmetric functions. How might they relate to one another? Namely, how do the Pn perps and the Pns commute, right? And so, in fact, if you think of Pn, so you have sim, you have Pn, you have Pn perp acting on it, and you look at the commutation relations, you have that Pn and Pm perp, let me get this correct, is n times, again, delta nm, right? And if you're familiar at all with this commutation relation, you might have seen it before, you'll notice that this tells us that the power sums and their adjoints generate an action of the Heisenberg algebra on the ring of symmetric functions, right? And that's exactly what we're going to exploit in the following way, right? So this tells us that actually the Heisenberg algebra acts on sim in this way, right? Where we're thinking of the Heisenberg algebra as being generated by Pn and Pm. And again, this is over Q. So you might ask, well, if we have these rational generators, do we also have maybe an alternate set of generators for the Heisenberg algebra that are also integral, right? Because our goal here is we want to categorify these things. And if you are familiar with categorification, then you know that you're looking for integrality in everything. So in fact, yes, right? Just like we have the Pns, we have an alternate set of generators, which unfortunately are called P and Q also. So I apologize for the terrible notation. But we have a set of integral generators. And of course, if at any moment you have questions, please interrupt me. I don't mean to speed through this. So we have a set of integral generators, which we can denote by Pn, let's call it Pn, right, and Qn. And here n, I want you to think of them as row partitions, right? So here n is kind of denoting a partition of size n. And this, under this identification, would correspond to our homogeneous symmetric functions, right? So this would be Hn, or its action on symmetric functions would be given by Hn. Here, the action would be given by Hn perp. And likewise, just like you have the Qs and the Ps that correspond to Hn and Pn, you have another set of generators, which we're gonna call P1n. Here, 1n is denoting a row partition, and Q1n, which again, this has to do with En, and En perp, right? So basically, the Heisenberg algebra is really just kind of encoding a lot of the relations that are happening here naturally. And in fact, all of the commutation relations that you have in symmetric functions within combinatorics, like that describe how HN commutes with itself, how they interact with HN perp, how they interact with the ENs, is precisely the same structure that holds for the different generators of the Heisenberg algebra. In particular, one of the things that we have are relations of the following flavor, right? So you have things like this. Let me get this correct. Z, M, and if you're summing over all the M and N, you know, relations that tell you how to move from one basis to the other. So PN over N, Z to the N over N, positive. So a relation like this is telling you, well, how do I go from one set of generators to the other, right? From the power sum symmetric functions to the HMs, which in terms of Heisenberg algebra generators would be, how do I move from the Qs and the Ps here to this set of generators? When you start seeing relations like this, if you're familiar with maybe vertex operators, you've seen them before, you'll note that this is starting to see, this is where they start showing up. So one of the, a very natural question that you might ask is, well, I have certainly operators that act on my ring of symmetric functions that are these basic building blocks, but can I build more complicated operators? Can I maybe take operators of this form and multiply them and construct something more interesting? And that is exactly where the Bernstein operators show up. Any questions about symmetric functions? I mean, this is meant to be hopefully something that everybody's familiar with. Okay, great. So then we have, well, maybe I will actually change boards for this. Yeah. So then this is where we start talking about the Bernstein operators. What are they? So the main idea is that given any arbitrary, let's say, integer a, you define the Bernstein operators to be the following thing. So you have minus 1 to the n, m, hn, em, perp. And you're summing over n minus m equal to a. And then you have its natural adjoint, which is defined to be minus 1 to the n, en, hm, perp, over m minus n equal to a. Right? And this is obtained precisely by taking, oh, too high. So just like you have that expression that tells you how to get from, disagrees with me. Just like you have that expression that tells you how to multiply the HMs or express the HMs in terms of the PNs, you have an analogous one for the E's, right, for the elementaries. What you're doing in order to define these is you're basically just multiplying the two expressions, one for the H's, one for the E's, and by expanding them, you get something like this. So what kind of properties do these Bernstein operators have, and why do we care about them? Well, to begin with, they have pretty interesting commutation relations, right? So in particular, they satisfy relations of the following flavor, right? So if you multiply them in opposite directions, one of these should be a B, B minus 1, BA. So relations like this, first of all, they don't commute, you know, and you have an analogous thing for the duals. So you have this, and then you have something more interesting where you mix them. So if you do this, so why am I bothering to write these equations down? Well, if you stare at them long enough, and perhaps you've studied Clifford algebras before, you'll notice that these relations are very, very, very similar to the defining anti-commutation relations that encode what a Clifford algebra is. The main difference being that somehow the indexing doesn't quite work. So these are almost Clifford relations, but not quite, right? And you'll see later on when I actually explain what the Clifford algebra is, that you can basically define what the Clifford algebra operators are in terms of these Bernstein operators. Cool. What other things do these Bernstein operators satisfy? Well, and the reason main reason why you these actually show up all over in combinatorics and the theory of symmetric functions is the following theorem. This is due to Zelovinsky, which tells us that if you take an arbitrary partition, let's say lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda n, and you act lambda 1 to be here, lambda 2, lambda n. So if you take these Bernstein operators, these infinite sums here, and you multiply them, and you act on 1, right? Remember, these are operators. They're acting on the ring of symmetric functions, where E and H are acting just in multiplication and how the perps are defined. Then you can act on 1. And if you act on 1 in this order by the following operators, you actually recover your Schur function. In the same way, you can define the opposite thing, right, by acting on the Schur function, and you recover 1. So the moral of this story is that actually the Bernstein operators are acting like creation and annihilation operators for Schur functions. So if you ever want to prove anything about Schur functions, you can actually recover a lot of the combinatorial structure by just studying these operators. Great, so this is the basic setup. And what I want to tell you now is, how do we categorify this entire construction? Symmetric functions, Bernstein operators, the Heisenberg algebra. Any questions before I move on to a different flavor of topics? OK, great. So what do we want to do first? Well, how about we start categorifying the ring of symmetric functions? That one's pretty straightforward, and actually a very, very old result. So this is a theorem due to Geisinger, or at least it was written down first by Geisinger. I believe it's probably older because it's just very, very fundamental. And what it tells us is if we take the Grothendieck group of the group algebra of modules over the group algebra of the symmetric group, and you sum, take the direct sum of every possible category of this form, and then you take the Grothendieck group of that, what you recover is precisely the ring of symmetric functions. I should put an isomorphism here. And the way you do this is by taking the Frobenius character. Right? And what this identification is doing is it's telling us that if you take a spect module on this side, spect module S lambda, under this map, if you take the Frobenius character of this, you precisely recover your Schur function. Right? Then the natural structure that you get on the ring of symmetric functions, like multiplication, co-multiplication, is actually encoded here by induction and restriction. So here, induction corresponds to multiplication. Co-induction corresponds to co-multiplication. Induction is basically the algebra structure, which is precisely the same thing I was doing, but possibly better. Induction corresponds to the algebra structure. Sorry about that. And then restriction corresponds to the co-algebra structure. So you're really getting everything that you want from symmetric functions, but categorically. So that does symmetric functions. This is an old result, nothing too exciting. And of course, this is not a unique categorification. As you know, if you've dealt with categorification, you know that there are many ways that we could categorify this, but somehow this is the most basic, one of the most natural ways of doing it. And for our purposes, this works very, very well. Cool. So then, now what we want to do is categorify maybe the Heisenberg algebra. And once again, we have a lot of other brilliant people to thank for this. There are many categorifications of the Heisenberg algebra we could have worked with. But again, we're going to just work with the most basic and simple case. So the category that we're going to work with is Kovanov's Heisenberg category, which I will now define. So what did he do? So Kovanov's Heisenberg category is a category that's defined in terms of objects and relations. It's a diagrammatic category. And we're going to define the objects as being generated by a P, which we're going to say is an upward pointing strand a Q, which is a downward pointing strand. And the morphisms are given by planar diagrams. So planar diagrams generated by a crossing, a cup, a cap, this one. Modulo certain relations on the diagrams, namely, so modulo the following relations. So if you take, let's see if I can do this correctly. If you take this, then this is the same as the identity. If you take triple crossing, this is the same as doing this. So it's got some very nice structure. And then you have relations, for example, like if you take this one is down and up, this is down and then up. This, you have the following relation, which if this is up and down, these just separate. This is zero. And then you have that this is the identity. And then of course there's another generator, which is this one, which is just the dot. But anyway, this doesn't matter. So what does this mean? First of all, it tells us that if you think of a crossing as just a simple transposition, then you have a natural action of the group algebra of the symmetric group on this category, right? This is telling you that partitions that are, that if you take a permutation and you square it or a simple transposition, you get back the identity. And this is just telling you that transpositions that are close satisfy the braid relation, right? So this is really just kind of encoding an SN action. Cool.
You have two SN actions, right?
Yes, of course you have two. Yeah, so I'm defining it just for upward strands, but of course you have the analogous structure for downward strands. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is just basically telling you how the two things commute or interact with each other, rather. So this category is defined in this way, but it's actually a monoidal idempotent complete category. So when you define these objects, you actually, or as generators, you actually then take the Kurubi envelope and then you get every possible idempotent. So in particular, this action tells us that, oh man, I don't want to like cover this up. I'll just write it here. Ooh. That is terribly erased. Okay. So what this, the fact that you have an action of the group algebra of the symmetric group tells you that you can define certain idempotents. In particular, for every young symmetrizer, has an image inside your Heisenberg category, which we're going to call H, right? So, for example, if you take something like the complete symmetrizer, right? So these are elements inside the group algebra of the symmetric group. If you take the complete symmetrizer, let's call it En, which is basically just saying take 1 over n factorial and you sum over every possible permutation, then this can be represented inside your Heisenberg category as just shorthand. We're going to use a box and we're going to define this in upward pointing strands, but again, you can define it analogously on downward pointing strands. Where this is an idempotent inside your category, right? So as an example, if you take n equals 2, then a box labeled 2 with upward pointing strands is nothing more than taking 1/2. You take the identity plus a crossing, right? And this is basically telling you if you have 2, well, what kind of objects live in SN? You have the identity and then you have a simple transposition. And that's exactly what this is encoding. So for everything inside SN, you have a corresponding image inside H, right? And these objects are very important, as we'll see. So we're going to call this, and I apologize for the notation, this is a capital P with an N, where N, again, is denoting a row partition, right? Because what are Young symmetrizers indexed by partitions of N? In which case, for every single partition, we can actually imagine that there's a corresponding image here inside H, which is nothing more than the image of like Schur functions, essentially. right? So we have anti-symmetrizers as well. So let's call them anti-symmetrizers, which have to do with column vectors. And these we're going to denote by black boxes. Right, and so this, for example, would be P1n, where 1n has to do with the fact that it's a column. And again, we have the exact same construction for downward pointing strands. So what do we want to, one of the things that you might ask is, in the decategorified setting, we had a category, but not only did we have a category, we had a category that acted on the ring of symmetric functions. So a natural question to ask is, well, does Kovanov's Heisenberg category act on modules over SN, right? The categorification of the ring of symmetric functions. And in fact, it does. The action, so it acts on, well, we don't even have to do that. We can just define it on this, SN mods. Its action is given by induction and restriction, right? So P acts by induction, by saying, all right, we're going to go from a CSN module to a CSN plus one module. And the way we do that is, if we think of P as an upward pointing strand, the action is given by just a labeling of the intermediate regions, where if you start with a region N, then you induce up to a region N plus one, right? And likewise, Q has to do with restriction. So its action on SN is given by restriction, where if you have a downward pointing strand and you start with n, then you're going to go down to n minus 1. So it's a very natural construction. One of the things that this tells us is that if we start with, for example, P, and we...
If I literally have topological field theories, and copies of the same topological field theory, will this have a natural interpretation?
Ooh.
It literally interfaces between.
Possibly, I don't know, honestly. Yeah. Okay, well, what I wanted, oh?
I was just gonna say that Sergey had written some stuff about this for these KLR categorification. I'm less sure about these ones.
Okay, well, what I wanted to say was that if you take lambda, so if you take our object P lambda, and you act on the trivial representation, what you actually recover is your Speck module. And of course, if you act on Q and you act on 1, you get 0 because you can't restrict the trivial module anymore. And the reason that this is important is that when we want to categorify these Bernstein operators, we want to show that the action is actually integrable. And that's important. That follows directly from this. Okay, cool. So what do we know? So we have this category. So why, first of all, does this category, why is this a good category? Well, because this is actually a very recent result. This is due to Ben in part, and then Alistair Savage, John Brunden, and originally by Kovanov. So together they actually showed that this Heisenberg category, if you take its growth in D group, does decategorify to the Heisenberg algebra. So it really is just recovering everything that we want. So what do I want to keep? Let me keep this, and then I'll define what I want here. Yeah. So what I want to do now is, using this category, define some sort of operators that, or some sort of functors that are going to encode precisely the Bernstein operators that we have there. And what's the methodology behind it? So in order to categorify this, in general, what do you do? Well, when you have a direct sum, right, the idea is that if you have a sum, then this is lifted to a direct sum. If you have something like a difference lifts up to a homological, to a homological shift. And if you have something like a chain, if you have something like an alternating sum, right, this lifts up to a chain complex. And so what this means is that if we have any hope of categorifying the operators that we have up there, we need to lift them. We need to categorify them as chain complexes. But of course, this is a little bit complicated when you actually want to do it in practice, because the chain complexes would be infinite, because of course, the sums are infinite. So that's definitely a problem that, well, was dealt with. So the categorization itself is pretty straightforward, right? And it's exactly what you would have thought just by looking at it. So what are we going to do? We know that our Bernstein operators have H's and E's. So our categorical Bernstein operators, imagine that this is different notation. I apologize. Let's make it a big bold B. So our categorical Bernstein operators, or our Bernstein functors, are going to be defined as what? Well, we're going to take the H's and the E's. So the H's are going to lift as P. Let's call it, so N plus M. We're just going to write everything in terms of one variable. So let's call this N plus A. And then the E's, E perps, correspond precisely to, the perp corresponds to 1 to the N, a partition, a row partition. And the fact that it's an E, the fact that it's a perp tells us that it's a Q. So this is going to be a P, N plus A, N. Right, so this is encoding each of the summons over there. The fact that it's an alternating sum is just telling us that it's a chain complex. Right, and so here we're going to define this to be N plus A minus 1. And every time you lose, this is, 1 to the N minus 1. Right? And remember that for every partition, right, for every single partition, you have some sort of idempotent that's living in the category. So here, the only idempotents that we're going to care about are those that are indexed by row and column partitions, not general ones. So we can define this chain complex in the following manner. We can define its dual by doing exactly the same thing, but rather we take 1 to the N plus A, Q to the N, and then we go backwards. So 1 to the N plus A plus 1, Q to the N plus 1. So here this is increasing, and then here this is,
A lot of confusion.
Yes.
In the category of the night board, this is a category or two categories, a category?
It's a category, a monoidal idempotent complete category, yes.
So P and Q are morphisms in the,
yes,
in the category?
Yes. Well, so they start off as objects, but you can define them as, it's kind of an abusive notation, really. What is this? This is the identity morphism from up to up, from P to P, yeah.
I mean the P1N.
P1N, yes. So P1N is an object in the Kurbian envelope. Right?
Okay.
Right, so sorry. Yes, exactly. So here I define the category pre-taking the Kurbian envelope, and then I define, all right, take the Kurbi completion, and then this is really, it's the image of the Young symmetrizer inside your Kurbian envelope. Exactly, yes. And so we really are thinking of these as being inside the Kurbian envelope, as objects, right? Which tells us that each of these are actually living inside, since we're no longer working inside Kovanov's Heisenberg category, but with the category of chain complexes, we're going to be working in the homotopy category of H. In particular, we're going to denote that by just K of H. And this is not bounded, it's just the full homotopy category, right? So chain complexes up to homotopy equivalence, because these chain complexes are unbounded, right? This is bounded below, but infinite above. And then its dual is bounded above, but infinite below, right? And so one of the things that we might ask is, well, why are these interesting, first of all? Because for all intents and purposes, these are basically just the same objects, right? I could define a zero differential and nothing would be interesting. But what makes them interesting is precisely that you can define chain complexes that are non-trivial, because you can define very natural differentials on here that are non-zero and still recover all of this categorical structure that I wrote, right? Or all that structure categorically as chain homotopies. And that's exactly what we actually end up getting. Namely, we have a theorem. So this is a theorem, which is just categorifying Zelovinsky's result, which is telling us that if we have a partition of N, right, and we act exactly in the same way, lambda 1, B lambda n, but since these are chain complexes, we're taking the tensor product of them, and we act on the trivial representation, then what we get is precisely P of lambda, the object acting on one, which, as I wrote up there, is nothing more than its than the Schreck module. It's isomorphic to the Schreck module. So just like downstairs you would be generating a sure function, upstairs these categorical Bernstein operators are acting like creation and annihilation operators or functors for Schreck modules. Right, and this is obviously up to homotopy equivalence because that's the category that we're in. And in the same way, we have the analogous construction, which is telling us that the adjoints annihilate Schreck modules, right? So you go down to the trivial representation. Moreover, just like we have the commutation relations up there, again, this is a theorem, that these categorical Bernstein operators satisfy, let's call them categorical analogs of these commutation relations, of the Clifford-like relations. And when I say categorical, I mean you interpret all of those relations up there as homotopy equivalences. I'm not going to write them down now, but at the end I'll write something that essentially is analogous to this, so you can see exactly how they would correspond. Okay, great. So this is the basic backdrop, all the combinatorial data, most of the ingredients that we need are here, and so all that remains to ask is, how on earth does any of this, what on earth does any of this have to do with this main story of bosons, fermions, the Clifford algebra, and this correspondence? Any questions before I, again, do a change of pace and talk about other stuff? Related, but you'll see how this all fits in. I'll let you think while I erase the board. Whoa, sorry. Okay, so bosons and fermions. Well, one of the things I told you at the beginning, which I kind of lied a little bit, is I told you that our Fock space was nothing more than symmetric functions. And that's really not true. What symmetric functions really are, for our purposes, are bosonic Fock space. And what we want to talk about now is fermionic Fock space, right? What is the space where the Clifford algebra most naturally acts? And rather than define what the semi-infinite wedge is, I'm just going to give you the flavor of it. So I'm going to say, suppose I give you a vector. And this vector can be written in the following form. It's going to be a wedge product of half integers that are ordered. Let me get the example correct, just because it's easier. Minus 1 half, minus 5 halves, minus 7 halves, minus 9 halves, and then here we go on forever. So if I give you a vector of this form where it's basically you have finitely many positive half integers wedged with infinitely many negative half integers such that eventually you stop skipping half integers, right? One of the things that you can count here is what numbers are missing. So for example, here we're missing a 9 halves, right? Here we're missing a 5 halves. Here you're missing a 1 half. Here you're missing a minus 3 halves, and so on. And if you count the number of things that are positive, so 3, you count the number of things that are missing that are negative or 2, and you subtract them, you can assign a number called to it, or a statistic that we're going to denote as the charge of this vector. And if you consider the space, so the span of vectors of this form, this is what we're going to denote as fermionic Fock space. So this has many different names. Some people like to call it Dirac sea of electrons, the semi-infinite wedge. Any of these notations is fine. It doesn't matter. But the point is that on this space, we have a very natural action of the Heisenberg algebra, or sorry, the Clifford algebra. And I also should mention that it's very natural that since you have this charge, this actually, the space is actually graded by charge, and that's known as the natural grading, right? So if we call this F, we have a decomposition of Q, where Q is the charge. the charge of all such vectors, right? So on this space, we have a very natural action of the Clifford algebra in the following way. So, wow, sorry. Ooh. So on this space, you said an hour, right?
No,
oh, okay.
That's not the end of it.
Oh, okay, okay. I thought I was timing myself. Okay. Okay, so on this space, we can define certain operators. Namely, we can define, let's call it psi I. And psi I is going to act on V, so on something like this, right? So it's just a sequence of numbers. Let's call it I1, wedge I2, wedge blah, 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 blah. Some semi-infinite sequence of numbers. And it acts in the following way. It's going to add an entry. So let's call it J, just maybe clearer. It's going to add an entry J in the J minus 1/2 spot, right? Because we're going to think of J as an integer, not a half integer. So this is just accounting for it. This would be I1, wedge, blah, 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 blah. And then we have, you know, a J minus 1/2 wedged in there in the appropriate place. And then we have a minus 1 to the, let's say, S, where S is dependent on how many spots it had to move on, if IS does not equal J minus 1/2 for any S, right? So if you can stick J minus 1/2 in your wedge product, you can insert it. So it's just a creation operator, and it's zero if IS is equal to J minus 1/2 otherwise, right? And likewise, we can define its annihilation operator in the exact same way, where it does precisely the opposite construction, right? It's going to give you zero if IS does not equal J minus 1/2. So if you can't eliminate it, then it's going to spit out zero. But if you can, it's just going to basically give you the same vector with that point removed, modulo a sign, right? So it's going to be minus 1/2 to the S, I1, blah, blah, blah. And then I'm going to write J minus 1/2, you know, removed, hat for removed. I don't know if that's standard notation, but yeah. Great, so why do we care about these operators that are basically creating and annihilating our fermions or our little vectors in our space? Because precisely the psi I and the psi I star, so the psi I and psi I star induce an action of our Clifford algebra on our fermionic Fock space. And what that's telling us is nothing more than the psi I satisfy the following relations. So psi I psi j plus psi j psi I are delta ij, or sorry, this is zero. And then the analogous relation with the stars, right, with their adjoints. And then you have the mixed relation right? You look at this relation, you look at the Bernstein operator relations, and you start noting that they're actually almost the same, right? So these are the Clifford algebra relations, and those are not quite exactly what we would like. So then you might say, all right, you define this totally alternate parallel universe. What on earth does this have to do with all this story about symmetric functions? And the thing is, they're actually kind of the same. And that's where the boson fermion correspondent comes into play. So let me explain that. Yeah, I totally have time. Great. I'm going to leave that one up there because I like it. No, I'll leave this one up here because I like this one better. Where'd it go? Chalk. Great. So one of the things that we actually first have is that actually this space, the semi-infinite wedge, is actually isomorphic. So this is isomorphic to taking infinitely many copies or infinite direct sums of the ring of symmetric functions. That's basically saying that each copy of FQ, each graded copy of FQ, is isomorphic to taking just one copy of symmetric functions, right? And this is assuming that we're keeping track of some sort of grading on it. So let's say over Q again, right? It's just keeping track of which copy of the ring of symmetric functions we're on. The reason for this isomorphism is actually very easy to see if you're familiar with the diraxy of electrons. So if you think of this as maybe a sea of beads, you know, black beads, white beads, some filled, some empty, it's very natural to construct a partition on it, above it, known as a Maya diagram. And through this, you can relate to every single vector of this form, a unique partition, a charged partition, right? That's important, which allows us to basically relate each vector of this form to some sort of Schur function. And in this way, you actually see that this is nothing more than the ring of symmetric functions, because the generators here precisely correspond to the generators of the ring of symmetric functions, which are the Schur functions. So this isomorphism is very natural, which basically tells us that obviously F is nothing more than just a lot of copies of this with some sort of grading on it, which is not very exciting grading. Cool. So then what that means is that if the Clifford algebra, right, if you have sim here, and this is, well, let's say infinitely many copies of this, and then this, you have fermionic Fox space on this side, you have an action of the Clifford algebra here, then absolutely, through this isomorphism, you can induce an action of the Clifford algebra on the ring of symmetric functions. What that action is, well, that's a different question, but you can certainly pass it through the isomorphism. And here, you have a Heisenberg algebra, right? Now, a priori, these two actions have nothing, absolutely nothing to do with each other. But the key point is that they do, right? And that is precisely the following theorem. So this is a theorem due to Cax, which tells us that if we write down the action of CL on the ring of symmetric functions, then that is realized through the following equation, which tells us that if we take psi I. So psi I here, I'm thinking of being the operator acting on the ring of symmetric functions. That is the image of the psi I here, right? So I don't have to write compose and precompose with some isomorphism. So just think of this as the image of CL acting here. So psi I acting on, so TCF, what is TCF? Here I'm thinking of F as being a symmetric function, and TC is just telling me, so TCF is just basically working in the piece that had, let me call this C. Pretend I have TC sim. So here, this TC is really doing nothing more than just keeping track of the grading that I'm on, right? It's just notational. So if I'm acting on the Cth graded piece of this direct sum, this is TC plus one, and this is where it gets interesting. Of our Bernstein operators, which I erased, right? These infinite sums of symmetric functions of I minus C minus one, whatever, acting on F. So really, what is the psi I doing? It's doing nothing more than acting like a Bernstein operator on the ring of symmetric functions and then shifting me up a level, right? And this is exactly why you have to work with a bunch of copies of the ring of symmetric functions, and you can't just work on one, because although the action of the Heisenberg algebra is just local and it stays on one level, the Clifford algebra jumps you up in the different levels, right? And analogously, we have that psi I star on TCF brings you down a level, no surprise, right? And then it does it by I minus C star of F, right? So really, if we want to categorify this construction, then all we really needed to do was how to categorify the Bernstein operators, which we already did, right? So what is the actual formulation of the theorem, or the construction rather? So it's the following. So first of all, how do we make sense of not taking just one copy of the ring of symmetric functions categorified, right? So if sim corresponds to a direct sum of CSN modules, we're going to take an infinite copy of an infinite sum of these. We're just going to think of this as basically a row vector, right? So a vector where each entry here, let's call it, I don't know, m, each m here lives in here. Right? And so what we want is to define operators that act on infinite dimensional vectors. And that's pretty straightforward. What acts on infinite dimensional vectors? Infinite matrices. That's pretty easy. And so our definition is the following. We define psi I to just be an infinite matrix that has zeros on the diagonal. So maybe let me be more explicit. So we have zeros on the diagonal. And then you define it so that it has these Bernstein operators, these infinite chain complexes living below it. So here, this would be I minus Q, B, I minus Q minus 1, B, I minus Q plus 1, and so on. So it's an infinite matrix with infinite chain complexes living in the lower diagonal, zeros on the main diagonal. And then you take psi I star is defined analogously, but rather than, so psi I star is defined in the same way, zeros on the diagonal, but rather than having the Bernstein, the categorical Bernstein operators on the lower diagonal, it has them on the upper diagonal, and it's the adjoints, right, the star version. So why is this the correct definition? Well, because these operators satisfy the following relation. Right, so we define these functors. And what we want is actually to categorify Kac's theorem, right? So this is the following statement, which is that if you take these chain these infinite matrices of chain complexes, they satisfy the following relations. If you take psi I, psi j, then this is homotopy equivalent to psi I, psi j, psi I with a shift of minus 1. Psi j, psi I with a shift of plus 1. And this just has to do with whether I was bigger than j, or I was smaller than j, or it's 0 if I is equal to j. And then you have the following relation, which is that psi I, it's hot, psi j star, homotopy equivalent to psi j star, psi I, star psi I, sorry. Let's see, 1 minus 1, I bigger than j, I smaller than j, and psi I star. So let me just write it out and I'll talk about it. Distinguished. Okay, so what does the theorem say? It says that if you take these operators, the psi I and the psi I star, these infinite matrices, then they satisfy this relation up to homotopy, right? So if you tensor them in one direction as opposed to tensoring in the opposite direction, they are equivalent up to a homological degree shift, right? And remember that a homological degree shift categorically just corresponds to when you take the Gerfling group as taking a minus sign, right? So these relations are precisely encoding the relation up there, which is telling you that if you add them, they add up to 0, right? And equivalently, the relation down here is telling you if you commute them in the opposite direction, but you take one with a star and one without a star, they commute up to, or sorry, they anti-commute up to a sign, right? Categorically, that's what that's saying. And if I is the same, then remember that in the relation here, all the way at the bottom, you have this delta ij, right? So if I and j are the same, then you get a 1, and that's encoded in the statement that these functors actually satisfy a distinguished triangle, when one direction and the other. So they satisfy two distinguished triangles. So when I wrote this out, I'm actually lying to you a little bit, because one of the key features here is that psi I and psi I star are infinite unbounded complexes, right? And that's a very technical problem. Namely, if you take the chain complexes up there, right? Because really, all that matters when you're dealing with these are these infinite chain complexes. If you take a BA, one of the normal Bernstein operators, and you tensor it with itself, or you know, BABB or whatever, then you get a chain complex that's infinite in the same direction. So they're both bounded below and unbounded in the same. Bounded below and unbounded above. And that's fine. So if you want to do homological algebra with them and you want to compute anything with them, the fact that they're both unbounded in the same direction but bounded in the same direction is great. The problem comes with this, right? So while this is something that holds completely and utterly inside the category, when you're working here, you're dealing with chain complexes that are infinite but in opposite directions, which means that if you tensor them, you're going to get something that's completely unbounded. You have no control over it. So if you want to do any sort of homotopy reductions to them, it gets very, very, very difficult. So actually, this result doesn't really hold for the chain complexes abstractly overall. It holds if you act on your space, if you act on the module over CSNs, right? So whereas this is a full result over just all the chain complexes, this is really just saying, let's act. Of course, it doesn't matter what level you're acting on, but it is tied to that. And that, again, that's just to deal with the fact that you have this bi-infinity that you don't know how to control otherwise. And the same holds for this. So one of the things that you might ask at this point is, if you go back to our picture, right, we somehow did only half of the equation. I told you how to categorize symmetric functions, our Heisenberg algebra, the Boson-Friedmann correspondence, right, which is precisely this relation, but I never told you anything about how to categorify a Clifford algebra, an infinite dimensional Clifford algebra. And in fact, that's a large part of the motivation behind this construction. It's saying, all right, can I somehow build a Clifford category by just bringing over the objects, transferring the objects over from our Heisenberg category? Unfortunately, although these are precisely the objects that we would want to build a category on, in order to construct a category, of course, we need to know the morphisms, right? And as Ben can tell you, one of the most annoying parts of this Heisenberg category is the fact that it's not Curl-Schmidt, it's not graded, which means that if you want to study the endomorphism algebra of any of these psi i's, it's very complicated. So that's still an open problem, which is basically, can we construct a Clifford category out of this? Presumably you should. And all that remains to study is the endomorphism algebra so that we can define what the morphisms would be, what the relations between the morphisms would be. But these are certainly the right objects to work with. Yeah. Any questions? That's the end of my talk. Yeah.
It seems like from the final relations, it suggests that there's like some Q version of the Clifford algebra where.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can completely define this. I mean, rather than working over SN, you can say, all right, well, can we work over Hecke algebras, right? That's one deformation that you could absolutely take. So rather than working with Kovanov's Heisenberg category, you work with a Q modification of it, you know? Sure, absolutely. You could define everything analogously and end up with some sort of analogous categorification. Another thing you could actually do is these Bernstein operator relations, which I erased, the decategorified ones, have a Q analog. So you might ask, all right, rather than work with these, can we work with those modified ones? So there's definitely Qifications of all of this. Whether they would actually be more interesting or be useful is a different question, of course. But yes, totally.
I even meant something like more naive, which is just here it seems like it's preferencing one order versus the other. The homological shifts are going in the opposite directions.
These, you mean?
You're seeing more than just the sign, you're seeing like,
oh yes, of course. I mean, if it weren't more interesting, then why would categorification be worth it, right? Yes, of course. I mean, somehow there's something more going on here. What it is, I don't know yet. Yeah.
But I mean, somehow, in order to Qify things, you still need some extra grade, right? If it's just kind of triangulated. I mean, yes, it's sort of interesting that there's this shift, but somehow. Well, you need to know something about the morphisms to know that you could add in a Q.
Yeah, I think in this context, you would have to go back to the beginning and just redefine everything already, like with a different category, just do it all from scratch. But just working with this construction itself, yeah, I don't know immediately how you would just drop Qs here and there and make it work. Yeah.
So, and this is a somewhat offhand comment.
Sure.
This sort of taking a big sum of the copies of the spectra group corresponding to the different charges.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would kind of rather think of that as I'm taking the degenerate affine Heck algebra and looking at the relations, you know, x1 minus all the different integers, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
You should think of those as different quote, all the different quotients of the degenerate affine Heck algebra, even though they're all actually just a copy of symmetric groups, right? And I just wonder if that somehow simplifies things.
Maybe.
That way. I mean, right, like you, those are genuinely different modules over the Heisenberg category.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because the dots act differently.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. First of all, in this whole story, there are no dots. The dots never show up at all, whatsoever. Nothing. They don't show up in the differential. They don't show up in any of the computations. They're completely absent. So in that regard, if the dot acts differently in both of those constructions, it would be irrelevant for this stuff. But that said, really, the fact that I'm dealing with like infinitely many copies of this is it seems more complicated than it is. It's really just kind of not encoding very much. Really, the core of it is the fact that you have these infinite chain complexes, and that's where anything interesting, I think, is actually happening. But that's my opinion, you know. I don't know.
Yeah,
because somehow, you know, you're like the category is semi-simple, everything breaks down. There's really, there's not any interaction from one copy to the next at all. And this the fact that you're going up a level is really just, it's a formal manipulation. It's not, I mean, maybe there's some extra structure that I'm not seeing. It's entirely possible, but.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's a little weird because you would somehow be wanting to replace these functors. Right, you wouldn't be able to act with something in the Heisenberg category
mm-hmm.
from one to the other. You would need some slightly different notion.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wonder if somehow things appear nicer when you think about it that way, but I don't know. Maybe not. Any other questions?
Is there a geometric realization of the categories here?
So that's a good question. And something I asked myself with the beginning. So from what I understand, Kovanov's Heisenberg category really doesn't have any interesting geometry, which means that geometrically, I don't even know how one would interpret this because the base object that you're starting with doesn't have much going on. There is an analogous, a different construction for a Heisenberg category that's due to Caudis and Licata that is very geometric. And you could ask the exact same question. What are these Bernstein operators in their category? Everything makes sense, right? Because all the relations all the P's and the Q's exist there. It's the same construction. The differential that's defined on these chain complexes is exactly the same differential that you would use in their categories. Everything should hold. And you could just as well ask, all right, can you construct a categorical boson from correspondence in their category. And then in that setting, I think a geometric interpretation might be more suited, just because their category is innately very geometric. But Kovanov's Heisenberg category really, it doesn't. It's like somebody once said to me, it has the geometry of a point. So that would be great if it did, but I know of, it doesn't, yeah. I mean, I don't know, Ben, you, in the other levels of the Heisenberg categories, is there anything interesting going on geometrically?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. There isn't some very obvious geometric origin for it. It's true.
Yeah. Thank you.